Hey, everybody. A couple quick updates. Well, this week we're supposedly recording our episode on the new Godzilla film, which is really cool because it's by the same guy who did Monsters. So that should be coming soon. We also got Prince of Darkness, which is related to the Worldcon fundraiser, and Usman Malik was the one who picked that, so we'll be doing that as well. And this month we're also doing a special torture cinema episode with Justin Landon, who supposedly can do a really incredible impression of Claw. So we're doing Inspector Gadget, which should be a lot of fun. We'll be recording that towards the end of the month. This episode is obviously Caribbean SF, which is, of course, right after my my love. And it should be really cool. I hope that you all enjoy it. The other thing I just want to mention is the Worldcon fundraiser for me is still going. And if you missed it before, basically at this point, we're just trying to get, you know, living expenses so that I don't have to eat, you know, air. So we think... I just got a donation today. I don't know what the total is at now. So, but there are only two milestones left. One of them involves Mike Underwood reading a classical piece of literature or philosophy as Kermit the Frog. And I'm going to be recording a similar thing, reading Nietzsche as Yoda, pretty soon here. So that should be something to look forward to. So on that note, thanks everyone who's helped so far, and thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 204.
Talking Caribbean SF with Karen Lord, Tobias Bakel, and Stephanie Salter.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And as Julia just noted, we have three special guests. I'm just going to go in order from left to right. So we have Stephanie Salter. Hello.
Hello, nice to be back with you and Skiffy and Fanty.
You want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Is this the tell everybody about yourself part? Yes, okay. I'm Stephanie Salter. I'm a writer like the rest of us here. My first two books are Gem Signs and Binary, both of which are out in the UK. Gem Signs only is out in the US at the moment. I am originally from Jamaica, though I now live and work in London where my books are set, so... it'll be interesting to talk a bit about where and how my Caribbean heritage filters through into novels that are actually about a lot of issues that come out of the region but are very specifically set in the UK.
Excellent. And the next person we have with us is Tobias Bakel. Hello.
Hi.
You want to tell us a little bit about yourself too?
Sure. I'm Tobias Bakel. I was born in Grenada. I grew up in the British and U.S. Virgin Islands. And I currently live in Ohio. I lived on a boat, and half my family comes from the UK, and the other half is on the north end of Grenada.
Excellent. And you also write some books.
Yes, I do write the occasional book. I write sort of a space opera adventure that has a lot of sort of callbacks to the Caribbean. And a lot of short fiction that does as well. I'm probably most well known for writing a Halo novel, an adaptation in the game universe, and currently have a few more books kind of planned and on the runway.
Excellent. And also Arctic Rising and the book coming out in, I think, October, which is Hurricane Fever.
Yeah, Hurricane Fever will be out actually in July, and that is sort of... will feature strongly a whole Caribbean setting, sort of a ecological, you know, adaptation novel featuring, you know, the Caribbean dealing with heavy weather and rising sea levels.
Excellent, excellent. And our last person with us is Karen Lord. Hello.
Hi, I'm Karen Lord. I am a speculative fiction writer. I've been called literary. I wrote Redemption and Indigo, Best of All Possible Worlds. Galaxy Game is forthcoming. Actually, this month, also a short story in the Jonathan Strawn anthology, Reach for Infinity. Reach for Infinity, yes. And I born in Barbados, grew up in Barbados, presently live in Barbados, studied and worked in various places from Oxford to Caracas. And I guess that although you do not necessarily see a recognizable Caribbean country setting in my works, you definitely see a sort of variation of what I perceive as being the Caribbean in my works.
Excellent. Okay, so I wanted to start off our very first question which about your sort of journey into publishing, because each of you have a somewhat different pathway. So I wanted to start, let's just start with you again, Karen. You know, sort of your, what was your publishing journey like?
I think that everyone's publishing journey can be a bit unusual. Mine is one that I can't use as an example for anybody. Mainly for me, it was winning the Frank Collymore Literary Award. That's a local literary award, but it's a very high standard in the sense that they don't feel any pressure to have a first prize every year. It's really about what meets the standard that gets awarded. So Redemption won, and it so happened that Nalo Hopkinson saw the local newspaper's website with an article about a fantasy novel winning this literary award, and she posted it on the Carl Brandon blog, where Gavin Grant of Small Bear Press saw it and was curious and asked her if she had a contact for me, which she did, because I'd finally plucked up the courage to email her and thank her for putting it on the Carl Brandon blog. So that was my journey into publishing, which is, as I said, a very strange one that not many people would be able to duplicate.
So you can blame it on Nella Hopkinson.
Oh, boy, I certainly do. I'm happy to do that.
Excellent. And what about you, Tobias?
Well, I became very much obsessed with trying to become a writer. It turns out the age of 13. I just actually kind of backtracked and found out. And that came about because I have ADD and a little bit of dyslexia. I'm very easily distracted. And in high school and in junior high and all throughout, I've always been reading to keep myself distracted and occupied while people lecture, because a 45-minute lecture or 45 minutes of classroom is really hard for me to focus. So I've been consuming books for as long as I can remember, and started trying to submit and publish stories when I was 13, and finally started breaking in when I was 19. And Nalo also features in my publishing journey, because she published the third short story I ever sold, which kind of got my professional, the hat trick that gets you into Science Fiction Writers of America. And she was putting together an anthology, and I did the same thing as Karen. I plucked up the courage to reach out, because I immediately saw that Nalo was doing things that were really interesting, you know, marrying Caribbean and science fiction together. And I was just really excited, and finally emailed her, and she said, oh, I happen to be putting together this anthology called Whispers from the Cotton Tree Root. And would you be interested in submitting a story? So I did. I managed to pull one out and get it to her in time, and got into that anthology. And she was really nice about spreading my name around later. And that was really cool that happened, and that we were able to work together like that. So it was very exciting to have someone like that to look up to as a kind of path, or to look at as a way of kind of, you know, saying that, like, hey, it could be done. And that's part of the journey. The rest of it is just a very traditional sort of, I sold a lot of short stories. I managed to get an agent, and then as a result of the short stories, and then I wrote a novel and managed to get that published through Tor Books. So I kind of took the traditional almost route that people kind of say, you know, to aim for. But the fact is, I've been working at it since I was 13, and it took until I was like 24. So kind of like a 9-year journey.
That's really not too bad. I don't think there are many authors who get published at 13.
Yeah, I was disappointed at the time. You know, you start out with that sort of like radical arrogance of, you know, that like, I can do this. I can write a story that someone should read and enjoy and want to purchase. And you send it out, and then it comes back rejected. And you're like, you're looking at it, and you sort of think like, you know, at that time, you're just gut punched. You think, you know, don't they recognize my genius? I mean, this was so amazing. I put so much work into this and they don't like it. And, you know, I sent out the second and the third. And by the time the third came back, I started to think like, maybe there's more that I need to reel. Maybe there's more I need to learn.
Excellent. So what about you, Stephanie? Can you tell us a little bit about your publishing journey?
Yes, I'm always a little embarrassed with this because it's been really easy compared to a lot of other people. And I don't, Nello Hopkinson does not appear in my journey anywhere. I'm still looking for an excuse to actually be able to reach out and meet her. I haven't had one yet. I did not have Tobias's confidence at such a young age. I've always been a voracious reader. I have a degree in literature. I mean, I've always been someone who read and as an adult thought through literature. But I didn't think I had anything to say or to say differently or to say really well until the last 10 years or so. And it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years ago that I basically took 6 months off and wrote a novel because it was clawing its way out of my head and I sort of had to get it out and I had encouragement from a couple of friends. But I'd never been a short story writer. I had no contacts in the publishing business. I had no idea about sort of fandom and blogging and short stories and any of that. But it was one of those things that you sort of write and you know that you and maybe half a dozen of your best friends will read, and beyond that, not much is likely to happen. And in fact, I finished the book, I edited it, I sent it out to agents because I did my online research and I discovered that that's what you were supposed to do if you were going to attempt to get a traditional publishing contract. And I knew that they were very hard to come by, but I thought, might as well start at the top and then go to plans B, C, and D as it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And of the 8 agents I sent it out to initially, I got 7 rejections and one who said, yes, please. And he got me a 3-book publishing deal with Joe Fletcher Books a month later. And that was it. That's my story. I wish I had the very emotive struggle over many, many years to write the book and get the book's notice, but I didn't. In the end, it was really easy. That's what happened.
Oh. Karen, I see you put up a hand there.
Well, I feel a little guilty. I gave you my breaking into publishing story and not necessarily my publishing journey story. Because the reality is that I wrote Redemption. The first draft of Redemption was with me when I was in the UK doing my PhD, and I sent it out to publishers and agents then and got nice rejections all the way through. And it was only when I came back and somebody who had given me early feedback said, enter this competition. And then the competition was the breakthrough, thanks to Nalo. But I shouldn't have made it sound as if I didn't try some of the traditional things initially. I did. And I got my share of rejections as well.
Well, excellent. Stephanie wants to jump in real quick. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I just wanted to ask Karen something because I hadn't realized that when, and just correct me if I'm wrong. So you won the Collymore on the basis of an unpublished manuscript of Redemption.
That's right.
Is that right? I hadn't realized that. I thought that it was a published novel. That's amazing.
Well, the Collymore isn't really for published novels.
Ah.
It's really as supposed to give you a boost up to get what you have published. Or if it's something that would be hard to publish anyway, like a poetry collection or a screenplay.
Right.
Okay. Excellent. Julie, I think this actually leads into your first question.
Okay. So I was wondering, all of you have really interesting backgrounds growing up in different places, and I was wondering what you read when you were growing up, and did you find that you were reading a lot of SF from your local area, or were you mostly reading things from other places, and has that changed over time?
Oh, we should say who should go first.
Oh, okay. Let's start with Toby.
Growing up in Grenada, I did not, and living on a boat, I did not have an access to a very fully fledged library system. It's one of the problems with being on a boat. You're sort of cut off from a lot of things. And so the way in which I read through most of my literature was through these take a book, leave a book libraries that are set up kind of in harbors. They're set up in hotels and dive shops and places like that. And it's just a handful of shelves and boat, you know, people who are living on boats just come in and they put in what books they've read while they've been sailing between the islands and take a few new ones that they haven't read. So as a kid, once I had like probably 10 books of my own that I spent a lot of time saving up for people that had given me, I would start just kind of putting books in and taking books out. And I started reading novels when I was 6 or 7. So I started like haunting those establishments as soon as I could and swapping those books out to find stuff that interests me. As a result, my entire education at the hand of books is in completely random Brownian motion. There's very little directed sort of any kind of guiding format to what I was reading. Anything that could hold my attention past the first like chapter, I would basically bring back to my boat and read. So I had a very wide exposure to just everything. One of the things I did not have a lot of exposure to was local Caribbean literature. One, because there was just not a lot of money in the education system where I grew up. Not a lot of really well-funded libraries. I mean, people did everything they could with what they had, but it was very, very limited resources on the ground in a lot of cases. And there were a lot of people who still, at the time, even though it was the mid-80s, a lot of people were really focused on canon. So when I got further up my education levels, a lot of teachers were sort of still kind of embarrassed or overlooking Caribbean literature, even though they might be from the Caribbean and not focusing it on as much. And it wasn't until I got to college here in the States that I actually started picking up a few pieces as I could find them from interlibrary loan systems. But I went to a very small college in a rural area, so it was always really tough to order that stuff in and get it. So as a result, I have these really huge gaping, you know, holes in what I've read that are really strange and really odd little, you know, tunnels that I've gone down. You know, it's something I think about a lot. I would have loved to have read way more Caribbean literature. One of the really cool things about getting to know Karen over the years has been that every time I go to Barbados, she kind of like spots, you know, areas where I'm kind of ignorant about a piece of literature and hands me a little reading list, and I get to go home with some new stuff to read. And it's always really awesome because that's the only way you can sometimes experience things, which is that, you know, you talk to someone and they mention a title when you're discussing a concept or something. And they're like, have you read this? This is really pertinent to what you're talking about. And you're like, I haven't even heard of this. And you write it down and you go back and you're that much more rounded out. So yeah, it's a weird thing because when I started out, I'd read far more science fiction than I had Caribbean literature. And it was really frustrating to me in some cases, because I feel like there's a whole area where I was kind of ignorant, uneducated, even though I was trying to, you know, look at the Caribbean and touch back on it with my science fiction. But I actually am very weak in that department and really wish I wasn't.
Interesting. Karen is very good at offloading books on people. And in case you didn't know, she sent me a few books before, and it was pretty awesome. So, yeah. Well, why don't we jump that question over to you, Karen, since you got name checked.
Okay. Well, I've been racking my brain trying to figure out how to make this as brief as possible. But I got a quick question for Toby. Tobias, did you not do CXC English, or did you do GC O level English?
I got shunted off into the American school system in the U.S. Virgin Islands really quickly after I came out of the British. Yeah. And so I missed that. So I got really good, you know, Caribbean history education and some of the early stuff from grammar school. But when I moved over to the U.S. Virgin Islands, it's very much U.S. school system. And so it was like no Caribbean history, no, Caribbean literature and stuff like that. So okay. That's why I kind of missed out.
Okay. Well, CXC, for those who don't know, stands for Caribbean Examinations Council. The GCEO levels is the British exam. At the time that I was at school, they were actually shifting over to the CXC system kind of subject by subject. So I had the chance to do CXC English. And what that contained was not only some of the Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury, but also some of Edgar Mittelholzer, a Guyanese writer who did this absolutely bone-chilling horror-slash-fantasy book called My Bones and My Flute. And we were given that to do in fourth form for our exams in fifth form. And this was something that, you know, kind of, I think, scarred us permanently, but in positive ways as well. and was to me one of the key examples, really, of this is 1950s work. So it's a key example of a very sort of early, what you might call speculative fiction. And yet, it's also an example of how it's hard to put genre boundaries on Caribbean literature. Because when you read it, you recognize that there are other aspects of Caribbean literature that incorporate speculative elements, but do not necessarily call themselves horror or call themselves fantasy. So you kind of have to sort of broaden your horizons a bit if you're going to think, okay, where's the Caribbean speculative fiction? It's really sometimes just hiding amid general literature. So I did have, as you could say, local exposure in terms of the regional writers. But then there were the usual suspects in our school library. We had Asimov and Clarke and Bradbury and all the rest and Le Guin. And we were ourselves reading things like even like Mercedes Lackey was, you know, being passed around to school. Lots of X-Men comics, New Mutants. Those were the days, yeah. So you know, you really just had a full mix of possibilities. And also horror. I never really took to horror very much, but I had friends who, you know, in third form were like, read this, and they handed me a James Herbert, and it scarred me again for life. And lots of Stephen King, of course. It really was the kind of school where people read anything and everything. And you know, there were, as I said, we didn't have, yes, you had the sense of SF or sci-fi being like your sort of pure space opera, rockets and robots thing. But there was also a very much an appreciation for literature that happened to have speculative elements.
Interesting. I find that interesting too. As I study a little bit of Caribbean literature, the nature of Caribbean literature to include the fantastic, but without being explicitly defined as genre, which is something that I think is perhaps why there isn't as much Caribbean SF as we would hope, because it's a lot of it just isn't identified that way. And if you're looking for Caribbean SF, as I sometimes do, I Google it and find the same four names, three of whom are on the show. and that's not a bad thing. That means obviously you're identified with this particular component, but it does become one of those things where like we need to start thinking about SF more broadly, I think, than just defining it by its terminology. But I see, Tobias, you had a hand, so why don't you jump in?
Sure. Well, I wanted to iterate that, you know, one of the big influences on me was growing up and hearing a lot of the oral storytelling, which was, you know, got to experience a bit of in Grenada. The number of old timers who would tell stories, you know, duppy stories, and just anything you can imagine, just a lot of oral folk tales, particularly when I would go visit family in Carriacou, which is a small island north of Grenada, and all the kids would pass along stories, and there was just a lot of a sense of the fantastic, particularly come carnival time. There was just a lot of amazing stuff that was in the air, and that had a really big impact on me. Even as a kid, I remember being really fascinated by those and paying attention to them a lot, and that is one of the early places, sort of my sense of wonder and interest in sort of you know, what you might even want to call magical realism or fantasy kind of kicks in. And those are really kind of common and part of the culture growing up. And having heard so many of those growing up, and to the point where I wasn't even sure that half of it wasn't just my imagination, but then when I got older and was reading about oral storytelling culture in the Caribbean, I would be like, oh, I've heard Anansi stories from family members. I'd never heard them actually, I'd never read them on print, but like I'd actually heard these passed around and was really kind of caught off guard by the fact that that wasn't just half remembered stuff from my childhood, but that that was actually real sort of stuff that, that came about from my 7-year-old memories. And that definitely is a big part of the culture and part of the storytelling down there.
Karen?
No, I just had to say I'm so glad you said that, Tobias, because if you're talking speculative fiction, if you're talking literature in general, anybody who looks at Caribbean literature and fails to acknowledge the oral tradition is missing more than half of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It is incredibly important. It is, you know, when people talk about influences, yes, I do sometimes fall in the trap of thinking, okay, who's printed, who's published? But that's not true. There's so much a part of it that is simply the stories you hear, the plays you've gone to, the comedians you listen to, the calypsonians you listen to. It's hugely important. It's very much a part of the culture, the storytelling culture.
Stephanie, we haven't jumped to you yet, so why don't we get you in on this conversation, but also your reading influences?
Yeah, I was just actually thinking as Karen and Tobias were talking about the oral tradition, it's interesting because I had the same experience of listening to Anansi stories and Duppy stories and so on. And at that age as a child, I don't know if they felt the same. I'm not sure that I recognized that oral tradition when I was a kid as being part of the same continuum of kind of fantastic storytelling as stuff from other countries that I was sitting down and reading. In the introduction to literature, well, I wasn't quite going from island to island on a boat like Tobias was, but I was growing up in the 70s, not that dissimilar in a weird way, because it was the 70s in Jamaica, which was a particularly isolated time in terms of just the country's politics. My family lived at the far end of the country in a very rural, unelectrified village at the time and had very little money. But I'd learned to read really young. But the reason for why that location was significant is that what I was reading until I was about, 12 and in high school was sort of dependent on the kindness of strangers. It was whatever passed through as people came and visited, similar to the boat experience in that people would come on holiday, they would leave the books behind that they were reading. And whatever they were, I would then pick them up and read them. And then, my parents would get hold of stuff, my mother in particular, and sort of, my mother had a much better sense, I realize now, than I did of what would spark my imagination, because she knew I was a voracious reader. So my entrance to fantastic fiction was my mother handing me the Fellowship of the Ring when I was 8 or 9 years old. And I absolutely fell in love with that, The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings. And then when I was a little older, in and amongst reading, any and anything that came my way, Jane Eyre was one of my favorites. I mean, it was about literature that sparked the imagination and took you somewhere mentally, as opposed to thinking about genre at that stage. I think my first big science fiction experience that was formative, that was as formative as The Lord of the Rings, was Dune. And again, that was the relic of some holiday maker who had come, read the book and left it behind. So it was very accidental. And when I finally went to high school, again, it was a very rural high school with not a lot of money for new acquisitions. And I read just about everything in the library, but I didn't know how much I was missing. I remember reading loads of H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and a bit of Asimov. Never heard of Michael Moorcock until I was in my 30s, probably because none of his books were in the library. So some things that are canon to a lot of people, I'd never heard of. And I had a similar experience to Karen in that they were transitioning from the British GCE system over to the CXC when I was at fifth form and taking what would have been O-levels. So I also did CXC English and literature. No, O-level literature, I think. But I don't remember any Caribbean or regional literature as such being on the reading list. I think I was the first year that it was available, and they hadn't brought they were still dealing mostly with the English canon. So when I was little, the only Caribbean literature I remember, there were three or four children's books. Some were based on legends, Three-Fingered Jack. I don't know if anyone recognizes that. That's a particularly Jamaican kind of folk hero from slavery days. And there's a bit of magic and there's a bit of trickstering and there's a sense that Anansi might have, you know, had his eye on him. And there are a couple of the other stories in which a bit of that sense of the fantastic aids brave children struggling against the odds very much in you kind of the Caribbean version of an Enid Blyton story. And that was probably it in terms of Caribbean literature. I mean, I don't ever remember having encountered anything I recognized that was a written form as fantasy or science fiction while I was growing up in Jamaica. Karen's podcast series in which she's talked about some of these books, Mittelholzer and so on, is the first time I ever heard of some of these writers. And it's quite interesting because I think I'm a little older than both Karen and Tobias. And one of the things that's happened as time has gone on is that sense of the only books that are worth reading coming from the British or the Americans or the Europeans has faded, and there's been much more of a recognition of the value of local writers, and they were much more on the curriculum of my younger siblings than they were on my curriculum. So I kind of came to speculative fiction through American and British writers and through this sort of strangely unbalanced mix of whatever happened to be in the library, whatever happened to not fit in the suitcase when people were going back. And so I sort of have a bit of a bucket list of things that I have discovered exist in my 30s and 40s that I had no idea existed because they were simply not around and not spoken of and not passed around. But the X-Men comics were, and the New Mutants, I remember those. So, you know, it's really interesting. I didn't know, apart from the like I said, the fact that the folk tale and the kind of duppy stories, the horror stories, which were an oral tradition that was just starting to get written down when I was a kid, and which I suppose if you had to class, you'd class a bit horror, a bit folk magic and magical realism. But that was the only Caribbean literature of the fantastic that I knew existed until relatively recently, the last 10 or 15 years. Isn't that sad?
I don't know if that's sad. That's not fair.
Well, had I known when I was a kid, I would have asked for stuff, because when I asked for stuff, you know, my parents were great about finding me stuff. So if I asked for another Tolkien or I asked for the second book of Dune, they would get it for me, even though we lived in the back end of nowhere. And I now think if I'd known these writers existed, I would have asked for them, but I didn't know they existed to make the request, which is one of the ways in which these stories and these voices, I think, remain, I don't want to say suppressed, but ignored, because if you don't know they're there, you don't know to go and seek them out. And I think that is quite sad.
Yeah,
that is really sad. And I think that actually leads really well into what I was going to ask next, which is, now that you're no longer children, do you find that you see Caribbean fiction in general, just not even science fiction, because I think I agree that you have to look within the general literature and you will find the elements of the fantastic within that. But do you find Caribbean fiction in general being more or less visible now than it was when you were children? And I guess I'll start with you, Stephanie, because you were on a roll there.
Well, do I find it more or less visible? The problem is I haven't lived in the Caribbean now for 20 odd years. So to some extent, it's not hugely visible to me, but that I think may have a lot to do with proximity, the fact that I'm just not there. It's interesting there, my whole life growing up in, you know, when I left Jamaica, one of my slightly snarky but not entirely untrue reasons I gave for leaving was that the country didn't have a decent bookshop. And to some extent, that's now changed. There are a couple of wonderful bookshops, but it didn't have much of that reading culture. There were the places you went to get your school books and your school supplies. And so I would encounter Caribbean writers in the larger world as opposed to them being hugely recognized at home. And just recently, because there has been a growth in literary culture and appreciation, and Karen and I have a date later this month at the Calabash Literary Festival in Jamaica, which I think is a big part of the reason for this improvement. Within the last few years, you're starting to actually have platforms in terms of things like the festival, in terms of things like the one or two bookshops that there now exist in Jamaica. I don't know if the other islands do better, where you can actually find Caribbean writers and therefore start to get a sense of that greater visibility. I mean, I think that's not a very clear answer to your question, Julia. I think in some respects, some people have been and are very visible. They are canon. They are Derek Walcott. They are V.S. Naipaul. They've been around for a long time, but they used to be the only names in Caribbean literature at all. There are starting to be more now, and they are starting to be more recognized, I think. And the internet probably has a bit to do with that because of the spread, because of the reach. And I think if I were living in Jamaica, my younger siblings who do live there are having a different experience than I did. They can find stuff by local writers. But having said that, I mean, when I went to this lovely bookstore in Kingston last year, because I was coming to Jamaica and I was launching Gem Signs there, they didn't have any of Karen's or Tobias's books and they didn't know about them. They had a section on Caribbean literature and they had a science fiction and fantasy section. And they told me that their biggest sales are the science fiction and fantasy section. But as far as they knew, those were all books written by white people in foreign countries. And they didn't know that anyone besides me had ever written Caribbean science fiction. And these are booksellers.
Interesting.
So, you know, they know now. We had a very long conversation. And I wrote names down and handed them to them. But again, you know, visibility where, I suppose, is part of what one needs to address with this. You can be kind of celebrated, but not necessarily in your own homeland. And I had to answer quite a few questions as to why I wanted to write science fiction, because it wasn't seen by a lot of people I talked to as a Caribbean subject.
That's interesting. Okay, we may have to come back to that. But Tobias, why don't you jump in on the same question?
You know, I also have that same distance that Stephanie has, which is that I'm living in Ohio, and things have been tight as far as travel, so I don't get to go back down as often as I would like. Where I grew up, Grenada and U.S. Virgin Islands seems to be a little bit more isolated in terms of the books and bookstore culture. I don't get the same – I didn't get the same growing up support for bookstores that some other people get in some other communities. However, you know, it's been a long time since I've been back, so I don't know what it looks like. I do know that there's one bookstore in St. Thomas that carries my books, which is the Dockside Bookstore in Yachthaven, in St. Thomas in Charlotte Mali. And I know that because every time someone passes through there when they're on vacation or if their friends are sailing through, they always swing by that store and they snap a picture of my book on the shelf and email it to me, which makes me feel good. But I think, you know, one of the more amazing experiences of my life in terms of finding an island that definitely has a strong culture of books from my perspective from going down there was where Karen is living, Barbados, which has I think Barbados has the highest literary rate in the world for a country. And it's really reflective of the fact that when I went to AnimeCon Expo, there were just so many readers there that I encountered that had already read my books. You know, when I went to this, it's a science fiction convention in Barbados, which to me was just like the perfect fusing of my two great loves, right? Science fiction and the Caribbean. And I got invited to go down there, and that's where I got to hang out with Karen the last couple of few years. And what was really cool, though, was just finding out that I already had readers on the island, which completely floored me. It blew me away that I had this built-in audience that showed up and was excited to meet me and had read my books and that I didn't even know existed. And that seemed to me a little bit more – that seemed to be a little bit more in place than I get the sense that it is in other places, if that makes any sense. And Karen can maybe talk about what the book culture is like from her perspective, but it seemed to be vastly more plugged in and healthier than book culture that I grew up with and was so encouraging. It's just for me, every time I get to go back down there to visit her in Barbados, and partly it's colored by the fact that I'm going to AnimeCon Expo, which means that all the possible science fiction and Caribbean readers are kind of like showing up in one spot, which means that it's a, you know, one time occurrence. But it was just very encouraging to go back down there and see this thing that I wish that I had been able to see when I was growing up there, which is just a love of science fiction and being thrown by Caribbean people, because it's like it's the perfect readership, isn't it? You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's that combination of the science fiction readers and Caribbean, and it just every time completely blows me away. Every time I completely love it.
And I know you talked about that convention before, and it does sound like a blast. It just sounds really awesome, and it would be a really good excuse for me to go.
Everyone should come. Everyone should come.
It would be really cool if it became like this international thing, and a lot of people from around sort of went and celebrated.
Well, it's been growing every year, from what I've been told. Every year it's a little bit larger. Every year they take over more rooms. I think so. You have to, you know, it's like thousands of people showing up for a convention. So it's larger than most science fiction conventions I go to in the U.S. and It is on an island that is, I think, somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 people. So when you think about it, it's a significant portion of the populace shows up for this. And I see Karen's got her hand up, so let's let her jump in.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, for their inaugural AnimeCon, their guest of honor was LeVar Burton. And I saw a bit of a snippet of an interview he did, and I think he was shocked at how many fans he got here. But, you know, it just goes to show you the seriousness of how they take that. So yeah, that's all I had to say.
Well, on that note, Karen, if you wanted to, because Tobias had mentioned that you might have some thoughts on the book culture, and this is actually related to one of the questions that Tobias has actually basically raised, which is the nature of either the science fiction and fantasy community in the Caribbean, or more widely, maybe even just the book culture. And you seem to be a perfect person to talk about that, since I believe we've talked about literary festivals before in either Barbados or one of the other islands, and I've forgotten. But do you want to jump in on that?
Sure. Well, you know, sort of counter to what both Stephanie and Tobias were saying, I almost feel too close to it. Not only because I grew up such a voracious reader, such a book lover, and was in a school that was, you know, so, I mean, I should quickly point out what our schools are like. We have something called the Common Entrance, which basically filters you by the grades that you get. So when you enter into a school, that's basically a bracket that's along your ability. So I was automatically in a school where there would already have been a lot of people who were intensely into reading. So I almost think to myself, I can't properly judge on a general level, because I was already immersed in that. And since being being a published writer, in a way it's almost become worse because I've made it my business to become acquainted with booksellers and to be aware of the literary festivals and the academic conventions and so on in the region that have to do with my topic. And because I am actively seeking out, I feel like I'm surrounded by it. The positive thing, I guess, is that since I'm actually finding it, I guess that does, in a sense, say that it's present, it's there, it's healthy and flourishing. I mean, Tobias should have told you how I first met him face to face. He was actually at what was it again? Caribbean. It was actually a Caribbean history convention, wasn't it?
Caribbean Academic Studies Conference, and it goes from island to island. Yeah.
Yes. And he was there, and I turned up specially one day only, you know, managed to like borrow a friend's car because I was like, I have to meet Tobias Bakel. and you know, it was fantastic because I wasn't published yet at the time. I probably did do a little bit of silly fangirling, but I'm sure he's forgiven me by now. And and this was something that absolutely thrilled me because you had the genre next to the literary. And that's what I mean when I say you can't draw these boundaries too strongly in the Caribbean. Now, you mentioned the conventions. Bocas Lit Fest happens in Trinidad. And that's one that I've been to and I very much want to return to again very soon. And again, this is a literary festival. But it was where I met Jeremy Poynting of People Tree Press, which is based in the UK and which is pretty much, its niche is Afro-Indo Caribbean literature. And when I later saw him in Barbados at our inaugural BIMLIT Fest, I was just about to join the jury of the Tiptree Award. And I was chatting with him in the Boufflé line as it happened. And I said to him, he was like, well, what do you mean gender in SF? And I started explaining. And then he said, oh, well, I think I have a book to show you. And he hands me Ghosts by Cordella Forbes. And I'm just blown away because it's literature. And I would never have thought to pick it up and read it, but it's an aspect of fantasy. It's near future. It's got elements of science fiction, near future science fiction, and it's amazing. And I'm just like, you know, here are all these like hidden things that unless you're plugged into the network, not just of SF lovers, but of literary people, you're going to miss these. Sorry, I'm starting to get a little enthusiastic. I'm going to calm down. but that is why I say to people, you know, I know that for some people who are enthusiasts for science fiction and fantasy, they will always target the genre conventions. Don't do that for the West Indies. Don't do that for the Caribbean region. You have to be able to open your eyes to several different things. It's really a case of, you know, like Stephanie said, the literature that takes your mind to a different place. And that may mean a very heavy use of fantastical elements or, you know, a subtle hint of, you know, this is the near future. Or it may be, something that's full on space opera. But, you know, we'll just take it in stride. It's still Caribbean literature. So anyway.
One of the other questions is sort of being raised by all of this is actually a thematic question, since all of you noted very at the beginning, to some level or another, your work is engaging with issues or themes that are specific to the Caribbean, but maybe not, and at least I think Stephanie and Karen, you said that maybe not explicit in your work. Tobias, it might be a little bit more explicit since many of your characters are actually Caribbean characters. So I'm curious what you guys think are some of the major thematic concerns that appear in either your own work that are maybe Caribbean or in origin, or in the Caribbean literature that you have been familiar with. And I guess we'll just start with Stephanie.
I should say it's interesting. I think that my Caribbean heritage has permeated my work a lot. And you've read it, Sean, so you'll know whether you think I'm just, you know, bigging myself up there. But I didn't know that when I started writing. And I'm not sure I knew that when I ended the first book. I tweaked to it at some point during editing. partly because what I write about is relatively near future, and it's a society struggling with a legacy of extensive genetic modification, among other things, and overuse of social media and the ways in which that has altered and stratified the society. But because of the genetic, the biosciences aspect, I wanted to find a way of telling stories and examining issues around discrimination and prejudice and understandings of humanity and degrees of humanity. And I didn't want to model it on existing races and tensions, because then they bring their own baggage. So I essentially created this structure of where your secondary or your subservient group actually are different because they've been engineered. And that, you know, that lets me do all sorts of interesting things as a writer. And talking about it now and thinking about it, it seems so obvious that so much of the history of the Caribbean in terms of the legacy of slavery, in terms of the color divisions, the class divisions, the presumptions about who is more or less worthwhile, more or less likely to succeed, more or less deserving of compassion or assistance. You know, so much of that very fraught history, certainly of my home country, but I don't think it's markedly different for Barbados or Grenada or indeed much of the United States, are very much the issues that my work engages with, but without actually having Black people, white people, Indian people, nappy hair, you know, I've created different artifacts to work around, but the issues are very much those issues of societal division, which are very germane to the Caribbean experience. The thing I haven't worked out is why I didn't know that until after I finished writing it. It just kind of, you know, there was a moment where I sort of sat back and looked at what I'd written and gone, oh, I've rewritten the history of emancipation. I didn't know I was doing that. So I suppose that's one of the big themes of my work. But it's not exclusive to the history of the region. I mean, I've lived in the UK for almost 11 years now, and what's one of the things that's fascinating is a lot of readers here who are not particularly familiar with that history read it and see an allegory to a lot of the dialogue around immigration and access to jobs that are very current in this particular economy at this particular moment in time. So you know, it's not exclusive to a particular set of legacies and histories, but those legacies and histories and the way they play out even now, generations later, I think that's the big thematic influence on my work.
Excellent. So why don't we jump to Karen? And have you sort of offer your take here?
Well, it's interesting because when Stephanie said that she wasn't aware in a way what she'd written until she finished, especially by the time she reached the editing phase, I do think that you write what's in yourself. You write what you know, whether you think you are or not. And really, it's only when you get the outside feedback that you begin to have the differences or the uniqueness pointed out to you. And this is something I've noticed even just outside of writing. When you're living in your own culture, there's so many things you accept as a norm. But, you know, go overseas, study or work for a while, and then suddenly things get pointed out to you or things, you observe things from other people, and you realize very abruptly what your culture is because you can see its absence or the change in how things are approached when you're somewhere else. So for myself, I think that one of the strong things that comes out in my work, and it's kind of hard to pin down one, but one of the things that comes out, especially in the best of all possible worlds and so on, is that I come from a microstate. I come from a microstate which, although it does, as with the rest of the Caribbean, have a legacy of various cultures, is probably a little more monocultural than most. Unlike Trinidad and Guyana, for example, we don't have a particularly large Indian community. And there is that sort of historical tradition that I think we're the only island that was continuously British Others sort of changed hands between the Spanish and the French and so forth, but we, you know, always fought off the enemy, as it were. And so you know, there's that aspect of monoculture, but then what I think is very striking in our history is the whole concept of you're a microstate with few resources. How do you make an impact? How do you keep your head above water? How do you make your voice heard? So I do find that sometimes my characters tend to be less the sort of front and center influential people and more kind of ordinary people who are trying to chart their course, trying to make a difference in their life in some way and not have external forces always be influencing and dictating what's being done. That's one aspect. Another aspect, which was definitely something that I learned very late, is that, and this is slightly parallel to theme, so forgive me. The cadence of my language is different. It's entirely different. When I am writing something and as I go through the editing process, I am made aware as to how I'm using standard English. I'm using standard English that's grammatically correct. I'm using standard English that's grammatically correct and has all the right spellings. And yet there's something in the rhythm and the cadence that is foreign to other people. And I only notice it when it's being pointed out or when somebody's trying to change it to what they think sounds better. And I'm like, no, that sounds wrong. So it's interesting because even the way that you speak, and I say this from the point of view of somebody who looks at foreign language and translation as well, even the way that you speak can affect the character of the person that you're putting in your book. So that alone puts a different flavor on things, which I find very exciting. That alone is what encourages me when I'm even looking for other work to seek out people who do come from multilingual, multicultural backgrounds, because the kind of difference of voice that they inject into their characters is what, for me, adds texture, adds color to the mosaic, and really makes me believe that they're talking about, if it's science fiction, for example, really makes me believe that they're talking about a galaxy of huge diversity. Mm. I've come across far too many monocultural or stereotypical galaxies in the usual space opera. It's very hard, I think, Bradbury managed it pretty well, but Bradbury is also the person who wrote the marvelous Wonderful Ice Cream Suit, which is very much a Latino story. So he still had that in him to be able to then portray humans who are Martians who are humans. I'm sorry, I got enthusiastic again. Did you get anything out of that?
Yes. I think, Stephanie, you wanted to jump in on something Karen had said.
Well, nothing. I share your enthusiasm. And I was just going to comment when you were talking about being aware of the rhythm and the cadence of your language is very specific to, and it reflects where you're from and that. I think that's absolutely right. I've read both your books and it very much comes through. When I write, this is just an interesting thing that someone else has said, I'm very, very careful and I want language to have a rhythm. I want it to sort of work if read aloud. So I take a lot of care with it. I'm not aware of the cadence and the rhythm being specifically Jamaican or Caribbean, but our mutual editor, Karen, Joe Fletcher, has told me that while you and I write very different stories about different themes and topics and so on, she thinks there are similarities in the cadence.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And the rhythm that we use. Isn't that interesting?
Mm. Very interesting.
Said, but Karen's wonderful, and I hope I'm good, but we don't sound like each other. And she said, no, it's not that you sound like each other or anyone would mistake you, but there is something in the rhythm of the way she writes and the way you write, and maybe it's similar education systems, I don't know. But from her perspective, being an English woman, she can see similarities. So I just thought you might like to know that.
That's really fascinating. And it does actually raise a question that Tobias may actually want to jump in on, not to
raise the sort of the big debate that's happening about dialect. So I don't want to like go into that bigger topic about Strange Horizons, et cetera, but I did because obviously, Tobias, you actually intentionally have written dialect in your work. And so I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that in relation to sort of these same issues.
So, you know, I wrote a very long essay about this, which is that, you know, my journey through using dialect is the fact that I have a very complicated background. One being, of course, that I don't have quite the strong dialect that people expect me to have when they hear that I'm from the Caribbean. And when I show up, I look white. I come from a mixed race family. But most of my mom's genes are the ones that hit me. So, and I lived with my mother on a boat in the Caribbean. So in some cases I'm away from the Caribbean because I lived there, but separated. It's almost kind of like that rural environment Stephanie was talking about. You know, I felt both of the Caribbean because my biological father and family and people that I would visit are all from the north end of Grenada and Carriacou and Petty Martinique. But then on the flip side, you know, I grew up speaking received pronunciation, a very sort of upper class private or public school accent that my mother had picked up with a hint of New Zealand. And that was what I had. Because she spent her years in New Zealand and Middlesex, London, Middlesex just outside of London. And so I received that from her, and that's how I was raised by her. And then my friends had a Grenadian accent, and it depended on which friends I was with, because some of the friends I had who lived closer to the hills had a completely different sounding Grenadian accent than my more middle class friends that I went to school with. So it was very strange to grow up because there were a lot of expectations based on what I looked like and a lot of expectations about what my, you know, like people would report back to my mom how I sounded. Some of my friends wanted me to just do whatever and I would, you know, have a dialect with them. And some of my other friends didn't like it when I would try to use dialect with them and they would tell me to stop it. And mostly I just tried to please whoever was around me and just kind of roll with it. And when I got to the States and when I got older, it became a little bit – when you kind of grow up a little bit more, you start overthinking things a lot. So when I was younger, you know, I would just try to sound like whoever I was around and fit in with them. But I always listened to what people sounded like around me because you're exposed to a lot of different dialects because – I would have friends from Anguilla. I'd have friends from the British Virgin Islands. I would have friends from the U.S. Virgin Islands. I'd have friends who were like, you know, expats and friends who were American. And this entire sort of melange sort of made me fascinated. And when I got to linguistics, it was the first time I heard the concept code switching and something that had been like this sort of shameful, convoluted, complicated thing where like my stepdad, who is from Ohio, you know, would occasionally run into me at school and hear me talking to some friends. And he would say, you know what you are? And I'd say, no, he'd say, you're ethnically confused, you know? And I would go like, I don't know what that means. I'm just talking to my friends, you know? And when I got to college, it was the first time I came across the concept of code switching. And it blew my mind because it was like, there was a valid explanation for why I sounded differently depending on who I was with. Instead of it being this sort of thing that, you know, made me confused and scared sometimes when people would challenge me about it. It was this thing I realized that like lots of human beings did, and it was perfectly okay. There was nothing wrong with it. And there was nothing strange about it. And there was no, you don't have to have one particular accent, and it's okay to flip around and do different things. And the more I learned about linguistics, I took a course in linguistics, the more it encouraged me to experiment with it on the page, which was something I'd wanted to do ever since I'd read a book called Islands in the Net by Bruce Sterling, which was the book that unlocked my desire to sort of do Caribbean science fiction. Because until then, there were things that definitely informed my work and I played with that were unconscious. But I think Sterling was the first time I had this epiphany, which was the first third of it was set in Grenada. And Grenada, we were talking about microstates and having their place within the world and how they try to operate which really resonates strongly with me because I think that permeates some of my fiction. But Sterling was the first time I'd read a Caribbean nation in a science fiction book being something other than a tourist destination and being a player in the greater field of politics. And it was the first time I'd seen the developing world being a player in global politics in a piece of fiction. And it was like someone had just like set off this like light bomb in my head, which left me with this super huge question, which was, why wasn't I seeing more of this? And there are a few things that I bothered me though about the book. As much as I was really grateful for Sterling for setting the first third in Grenada, and even though it kind of completely changed the entire course of what I would do from then on, there was this one small sentence in it where Sterling happens to mention that somebody who had had this Caribbean dialect throughout the book switches to, you know, quote unquote, normal dialect. And the insinuation in the sentence, and I circled it and have a bunch of question marks next to it in my copy from when I was in high school. And the insinuation is that the dialect was something that was put on for tourists and that this person was switching to their normal sounding voice, which at the moment kind of blew my mind because, being on the other side of it, I thought, no. That's not what happens when someone does that. What they're doing is switching the dialect to talk to the tourist to something a little bit more even. And in fact, if he was putting on his full dialect, you would probably have a lot of trouble understanding him. And this one sentence was the kudos to Sterling for trying and doing so many things right in that. But that was the one sentence where I went like, oh my gosh, he doesn't get it at all, does he? You know, and I was like, now I need to go out there and try this and show it and do it and show that this is actually the dialect and talk about code switching and let characters change dialects and play with it. And I became quite obsessed with doing that. I don't know if I do it well. I don't know if I do it perfectly. I sometimes get readers who are frustrated from the Caribbean who don't like what I've done. Then I get many readers who are very excited that I've done it. So it's just one path. And the big controversy hanging out there is whether or not whether or not someone writing in science fiction needs to water it down or to change it to make it easier to read, or whether you should go for full-on authenticity. And I don't think there's any one right answer to that. I think it really depends on what the writer's trying to achieve and what they're wanting to do. And I think it's a question that is in the writer's – that's for the writer to think about and decide. And the reason I wrote this very long essay on my website was I really wanted people to not ever look at me and say, like, he's doing it right. Everyone should try and do it like him, because there's so many different ways. And having caught up on some of the literature that Karen has passed me and gotten to read some Caribbean literature far more in my 30s and late 20s than I did when I was in school, there are a lot of ways to do it, and there's no right way. And I was very frustrated that I had been cited as a way to do it right, and I felt like I didn't want my name to be used as kind of a way to force someone to change a manuscript. I don't mind being used as an example. I don't mind someone pointing me out, or I'm really honored when someone says it's really cool that he's doing it. But it was terrifying, and I felt like a lot of weight was on my shoulders that impacted someone else's artistic ability. And I don't ever want to get in the way of someone else's expression. So for me, dialect has been something I've played with a lot. But it was mildly I felt like it was an unpleasant experience to see my name being used as a way to mold someone else's writing. A bit terrifying. I guess it's something that might happen now that I've been in the field long enough, but it was still something I wanted to kind of put a marker down and say, you know, please remember that I am just one possibility and there are many, many other possibilities. And I see Karen has her hand up.
Yeah. Go ahead, Karen.
No, I'm really excited about what Tobias is talking about, because there are aspects of the code switching discussion that are important not only from a linguistic point of view, but also from a societal point of view. And I'm especially interested that he said, you know, he didn't want to be held up as an example. This is the way you do it, because there's several ways to do it. I want to point out right now, I've never been to Jamaica. I will be in Jamaica for the first time in my life at the end of this month for Calabash. I went to see a Jamaican movie called Dance Hall Queen, There were no subtitles. I only enjoyed that movie due to the fact that I had a friend next to me who had studied in Jamaica and was able to translate for us. Okay? We are some fairly scattered islands. We've actually got some quite different histories. There are many ways in which we're similar. There are many ways in which we're quite different. So if you look at one Caribbean writer and say, aha, this is what it is, boy, you're so wrong. So that's one thing I want to point out. And the thing about code switching and society, there's a brief moment of code switching in the Best All Possible Worlds. And I kind of had a fight for it because there are, in fact, some people who only recognize dialect when it's full-on dialect, when it's full-on, I can't quite understand what's happening here, so it must be dialect. And then there's the kind of almost mild dialect, which is sort of closer to standard, which is more relying on how things are pronounced, maybe some slight changes in grammar, but it's still a change. And then the bit that confuses people, and it's interesting, Tobias talking about, you know, his stepfather's reaction and so on, and the way he spoke with his mother. From my culture's perspective, dialect was something you never spoke to your parents because it's a question of, I don't know, it was almost a question of respect. So your elders would not hear you speak dialect. Your friends would hear you speak dialect. Your elders could speak dialect to you, but you were not to reply in dialect. Do you see what I'm talking about when I'm talking about societal aspects? It's very convoluted. And these are things sometimes that I'm putting into my books without even thinking about them more than even examining them closely. Until then somebody comes out of feedback and says, oh, but why is so-and-so talking dialect and the person who's replying isn't? And I'm like, but can't you see I'm trying to indicate that there's an actual societal gap between them, that, you know, one person's superior and the other one's inferior. And I'm like, no, Karen, you can't assume that because they don't know the background you're coming from. So there's just so much packed into the concept of code switching that I am learning as I go along because I can't assume that I know your culture fully. I can't assume what you don't know about mine. So much of this encounter is me also figuring out what my reader's going to think when they read my stuff. And there are times I'm sure that I get it wrong. So it's a field of rich discovery. That's all I can say.
Excellent. Yeah, I totally agree. So Stephanie, last comment's going to you, but you got to be kind of quick because we've got 4 minutes to close out. So.
And it was just really When Tobias started talking about code switching, I was nodding along here because I had exactly the same experience. And it wasn't until I was in university in anthropology and linguistics classes where the name got put to the thing that I'd been doing my entire life. And I realized it wasn't a weird or somehow transgressive act to switch accents, languages, terminologies. But this is not, you know... So I had that experience as well, but I was thinking, listening to Tobias and Karen talk, the interesting thing about code switching and about using language and accent and dialect is the value judgments that attach to language. And I think what we're coming out of here, and a lot of it has to do with levels of education, levels of, I don't know, social maturity maybe, is moving away from the old school placing of the highest value on a homogenous way of communicating, and that homogeneity conforming to whatever has been the dominant culture, the dominant language. You know, it's what Karen just said about it being considered disrespectful, or in my case, and here's a loaded term, low class to speak dialect. It was the thing that certain classes of people did. And you didn't do if you weren't among, you know, you were doing yourself down.
It's like Pygmalion all over again, isn't it?
Absolutely. Entirely. Yeah. But it's interesting the way that paradigm is reflected in so many other places and in so many other conversations, not least the one we're not going to talk about, which Tobias's essay was partly in response to, the whole Strange Horizons fracas that came out earlier this year. But there is that thing about, you know, what do you define as authentic? What's considered to be a mark of authenticity versus what's considered to be some sort of, a gimmick? What the authenticity versus gimmickry is an interesting is an interesting topic here. And I was struck listening to the others talk about it, that you don't get this in literary fiction, I don't think, to the same degree. There's something about it being presumed to be a mark of the highest levels of literary authenticity. If a work that is packaged as litfic uses dialect, uses accent, uses code switching in all the ways that we've been discussing, it's the high value is placed on it simply because of it being packaged in that way, whereas somehow it's not presumed to be a similarly high-minded intellectual exercise if that appears in a genre novel. Now, I don't know if I'm just making that up, but I was thinking that as I was listening to the two of you speak, and I know we're out of time, but I'd love to know if you think that I'm completely off base on that.
Okay, well, we're seriously out of time, so we're going to have to leave that as an open-ended question. Because I do got to make sure that we close out so Julia can scat to do her stuff. So really quick from everybody. So we'll start with Stephanie. Just let people know where they can find you on the interwebs, you know, so they can go check out your work, et cetera. So real quick, Stephanie, where can people find you?
StephanieSolter.com, and I'm on Twitter as Scriptopus.
Excellent. Tobias?
I'm at www.TobiasBakel.com and on Twitter as Tobias Bakel, and fairly easy to find.
Excellent. And Karen?
I'm on Twitter at Karen_Lord and on Tumblr, but you know, the link is actually in my Twitter profile, so it's probably easier. It's probably something like Dr. Karen Lord. I'm not sure.
Okay, excellent. Okay, well, thank you, Julia, for joining me for this episode.
Yeah, thanks. It was really fascinating.
And thank you, Stephanie and Tobias and Karen for coming on. And I wish we could keep talking, but then we'll be here for 16 hours with just great conversation. So, but thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. And on that note, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog, too, you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/SkiffyandFanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And yeah, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.